The Tom Woods Show, episode 1972.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Harry's, the official razor of the Tom Woods Show, is offering listeners their starter set at harrys.com/woods. That's a 5-blade razor, a weighted ergonomic handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover, a $13 value, all for just $3 at harrys.com/woods. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I'm joined today by David Limbrick, who is an elected official in Victoria in Australia. I'm going to have him introduce himself to you in just a minute. But of course, we're going to be talking about the situation in Australia, what's happening there. I don't know what the prospects are, but it's looking pretty grim. And I wanted to get a report from on the ground from somebody who has been observing it close up. And David undoubtedly fits that bill. David, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the COVID situation over there, as an American, I know nothing about your system of government. I mean, you know, I suppose I know a little. But can you, first of all, explain what part of the country you represent and how long you've been in office and how long your terms are and things like that?
Yes, no worries. So I'm from the state of Victoria. I'm a upper house member, so like a state senate. I'm from a minor party. Now, everything's backwards with names compared to America, but I'm from a party called the Liberal Democrats, which will mean something very different to Americans. But in Australia, we're basically a libertarian party. And we've got two members in our state senate that are elected here, and including that's one of those is myself. Also in Victoria, so Melbourne is the capital of Victoria. Also in Melbourne, the party that rules Victoria, that is currently in power, is called the Labor Party, which is, I suppose, sort of similar to the Democrats in the US. And federally, we have what's called the Liberal Party, which I suppose would be sort of similar to the Republican Party in the US. But yeah, but a bit different. But our terms are in Victoria, we have 4-year fixed terms. So I was elected in November 2018. Yeah, so I've been around since 2018. That's the first time I've ever been elected to Parliament. Before that, I worked in the finance sector.
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to ask what you'd been doing before that, because you haven't been in elected office all that long. You sure picked quite a time to get into it.
Yeah. Well, I've been involved in our party here since about 2013. We've been, you know, working really hard. We're only a minor party, so we've been working really hard to get people elected. We did get a federal senator elected back in 2013. We've also had a state senator elected in the state of Western Australia. But Victoria in 2018, that was sort of our best outcome yet when we got two of us elected to the state senate. And we're hoping, you know, there's going to be a federal and another state election next year, and we're hoping to increase our representation. Yeah.
Well, let's see. So when people elected you, obviously, the society was more or less normal.
Yes.
And now we've had, obviously, all this. And I'm curious to know what you think. You must have a bit of the pulse of the people. What people are thinking right now after a year and a half of what the rest of the world really, I think, does consider rather extreme measures. And given that you are apparently at least a political outlier when it comes to this, how popular do you think you still are? I'm just going to be very blunt about it.
Well, I think we've gotten more popular than ever. No one had really heard of us much before we got elected. And our popularity in Victoria in terms of, you know, media coverage and social media following and all that sort of thing has skyrocketed, and our party membership as well. And I think a lot of it's got to do with our stand on what's been happening during these, you know, draconian restrictions. I think Australians have gotten, for a long time maybe, we've taken our liberties for granted in Australia. And all of a sudden, they've been taken away very, very quickly and in a very extreme manner. And people are looking around and saying, who's actually defending our liberty now in Australia? And it just so happens that our party's been around for 20 years, and that's pretty much was the whole purpose of our party existing. And we've been defending it quite strongly and getting a lot of support for doing so.
I'll never forget, I had an Australian academic on the program some years ago, and he said that he has a little trouble getting traction for what we would call libertarian ideas there, because he says that the general tone of Australian society and the general approach that people take is very, very moderate, that people generally don't run to extremes in Australia. And so at a time like this, well, first of all, I don't think there's anything extreme about our position, but I'm very much against what the governments of the world have been doing. So that just by definition, because I'm almost alone in feeling this way, you know, vis-a-vis these governments, there are a lot of people who believe this way, I think I would be positioned as an extremist. So I wonder, do you feel like, we get the sense in the U.S., that here in the U.S., we have a lot of dissenting voices. There are a lot of people who really don't like what's going on. There are some states in the U.S. that have defied a lot of it. But in other countries, like in, I've heard that like in the Philippines or in Malaysia or Thailand or whatever, there's no dissent. There are no dissenting voices whatsoever. Now, the impression that we get from Australia is we see some protests here and there, but there can't be that much opposition to how would they get away with this for so long. So what do you think is happening? And is Victoria different from other parts of the country in terms of the way that people think?
Yeah, look, they've crushed dissent in many ways. Now, Victoria, what's happened to our federation in Australia is all of the states have had very, very different experiences. So Victoria has had the harshest and most sort of draconian lockdown that we've seen. Like, you know, we're currently in day 220-something of lockdown six. And when I say a lockdown, currently we're only allowed to leave our own homes for five set reasons. That is to get exercise, to seek medical treatment, to purchase some essential supplies, to get a vaccination, or to provide medical aid to someone. We're allowed to leave our home for 2 hours a day for exercise. Only permitted workers are allowed to work. The reason you don't see protests is because protests are effectively illegal. You will get shut down by police very severely. And I think there's a lot of opinion turning against what the government is doing. But if you look at like a state like Western Australia, they've had, you know, zero COVID for a long time. They've basically isolated themselves from the rest of the country and the rest of the world. And they're sort of acting like a hermit state. So they're in a very different position and a very different experience to Victoria.
I've heard that the government of Australia has said something about vaccination rates being tied to when things can at least remotely begin to approach normal. But I've also heard that the rollout of the vaccines has been excruciatingly slow in Australia.
Yeah, it's been slower than many would have liked. But yes, they're talking about tying freedoms to vaccination rates, which is extremely concerning to me. So what's happening in Victoria is there's people that are stuck outside of the state. So they might have gone on a holiday in between lockdowns. And then when there was another lockdown, they closed the state border and they got stuck on the other side of the border. So they're like a, you know, internally displaced refugee effectively. And they've said to them, oh, well, you can't get back into the state until you've been vaccinated. And then the premier of our state is a premier, sort of like a governor. The premier is saying people who aren't vaccinated won't be able to participate in the economy to the same way as other people will. And companies are talking about enforcing vaccination mandates on staff, you know, at the government's behest. And so we're in this sort of situation where I feel I've been talking out about it and calling it basically, you know, medical apartheid, the idea that a medical procedure is going to determine whether or not, you know, you have the same rights as other Australians, which I find abhorrent.
Well, one of the things I've heard out of New Zealand, and I don't know if the same thing is true in Australia, is that at least some members of the public look at the fairly good numbers that their country has had compared to a lot of other countries, the good results that they've had, and they say this is because our country is uniquely virtuous and we follow the rules and we're obeying the rules, and that's what's kept our numbers where they are. And so there's frankly a sense of moral superiority. Now, the United States is used to dishing out the moral superiority to the rest of the world. We're not used to hearing it, you know, shoveled at us from other places. And so that's been a way that the people of New Zealand at least have been propagandized, that they've been encouraged. Look, you guys are great. You guys are the best in the world. Look at what we've managed to do. Same kind of thing in Australia?
Well, they were doing that for a long time. And, you know, they're pointing, which country they're pointing to as an example of, you know, who was superior to seems to change every month. But I think it's gotten to the point now where the harms from these lockdowns are so blatantly obvious to everyone that many people are questioning whether the cure is worse than the disease. You know, my main concern, you know, apart from the economic devastation, but my main concern has been around the harms to children, because children aren't in school at the moment. They've been taken out of school. They're not allowed to see their friends. They can't visit their friends, and they haven't been able to do so for hundreds of days now. And so we're seeing all sorts of aberrant behavior in children. And there are many people, like medical professionals, that have been, you know, desperately reaching out to people like me and others and ringing alarm bells and saying, you know, we're going to have a generational catastrophe here. Like, these children are showing very unusual behavior. Some of them including, you know, self-harm. There's going to be harm to their education, harm to their physical health from, you know, just being inside for so long. And, you know, small businesses have been annihilated to many degrees. You can imagine what, you know, running a restaurant must be like in Melbourne under these sort of conditions at the moment. Basically, you can only take away. So it's created this new sort of order. And I see it as like a new class system almost. We have like what some people have been referring to them as the laptop class. So the people that can work from home, maybe they work for government or they work for a big corporation, and they can continue getting a paycheck and they can, you know, basically keep going with their lives, versus these other classes who are, you know, consist of, you know, parents who are worried about their kids because they can't go to school, small business people, other industries that have been deemed, you know, non-essential, and they're effectively surviving on, you know, government handouts at the moment. And they're angry. They're really angry. And there's this big new class divide. And I think politics is going to be really shaken up over it, because it doesn't divide along normal lines as it did historically.
Yeah, we see a little bit of that in the U.S. Like, I see some people on Twitter, for example, saying, I've been a lifelong Democrat in the U.S. and I just cannot support what they're doing at this point. But overall, what's happened is this has become extremely polarized for the most part along traditional partisan lines. And although I know there have to be people among the Democrats who secretly think this is all a mistake, they're afraid to say that because then they'll be accused of having supported Trump. The intellectual level of the political discourse in the U.S. is at the lowest IQ level you can possibly imagine. I don't know if it's any better in Australia. But I guess my question is, what's happened here, because it's become so bitterly divisive, this whole question of where you stand on the various alleged mitigation measures and restrictions and so forth, is that both sides have dug in their heels so much that no matter how much data you bring forth, and it could even be about children and the way they're suffering, these children are not having normal lives. And this has been going on for a year and a half with no end in sight. I mean, this is insane how people can do that. The selfishness of these politicians is insane to me. But they've dug in their heels to the point where I can show them every chart in the world, doesn't change their minds. Is there a little bit more prospect of talking to people rationally in Victoria?
I think in many ways it's probably even worse here, because rather than having a polarized view, the two major parties, which, you know, are basically a duopoly, they've formed what they call a national cabinet, where the leaders of every
state. Oh, no. That sounds terrible.
Together. Yeah. So New South Wales is under a Liberal Party, which is like what I was saying, they're sort of like a Conservative Party. They're doing measures that are just as draconian as Victoria. So we have this situation where there's only sort of smaller voices such as myself that are speaking out against what's happening here. But I think that there is a lot of people that are really concerned about what the government is doing, especially in New South Wales and Victoria, where New South Wales is where Sydney is, of course. But yeah, they're sort of in lockstep over this in many ways, which makes it very, very difficult.
So right now, you're still in this. I mean, this is very, very hard to believe that people would tolerate this for so long, especially because I, although I follow the news, in my personal life, I'm very much sheltered from this in that I take trips, I fly around the country, I go to the beach, I go to the movies, I go to see plays, I go to concerts. I saw two concerts in a week a couple of weeks ago. I go to Las Vegas and gamble and go to shows. I more or less live as robustly as one can live under these circumstances. And this is absolutely unthinkable to anyone in Australia right now.
Victorians are literally prohibited from leaving, from moving more than 5 kilometers from their house. The idea of, you know, going out to restaurants and you know, going out and living your life seems like fantasy to us at the moment in Victoria. And it's intolerable for many, many people. It's intolerable. And there is dissent. There are people that have tried to protest and they've been brutally suppressed by the government. You know, we've had this escalation of protests. I've attended a few. You know, I consider it my job as a member of parliament to, you know, witness and listen to what people have to say and to observe the police response. And what I've observed is an escalating suppression of what's happening. And at the last one, which I didn't attend, but I've seen lots of video of, they actually opened fire on protesters for the first time with less lethal weapons. So they've always used things like, you know, pepper spray and things like this. But, you know, at the last one they used, I think they're called batten rounds or beanbag rounds, pepper bullets, gas canisters, this sort of thing. And so, you know, they've really ramped it up and trying to intimidate and demonize any sort of dissent. You know, anyone who asks questions about what the government is doing, the government and the media sort of try and smear them as, you know, either morally reprehensible or conspiracy theorists or extremists or anything like that to try and, you know, try and get to a point where people feel uncomfortable openly expressing any sort of dissent with the government. And, you know, I've gone along to these, like I said, I've gone along to these protests. I've spoken to these peoples. And of course, at any protest, you get a few fringe elements. But most of these people that I spoke to, they were people who were upset because they lost their job, are upset because their business had been destroyed. They're worried about their kids. They're worried about human rights suppression. They're worried about all these sorts of things. And these are very legitimate concerns that I'm very sympathetic to. And the idea that that sort of dissent would be suppressed in such a severe way is very worrying.
Well, I seem to recall hearing that not too long ago during this most recent spike in so-called cases there, that Scott Morrison had something interesting to say, that he said something along the lines of that, I mean, it was a strong implication that the zero COVID approach is not sustainable in the long run and that what we need to focus on instead are people actually getting sick and going to the hospital. Yeah. So at some point, we have to look at it that way. But the some point, I was told by somebody else, will be after the country is 80% vaccinated. Am I getting that right?
Something similar along those lines, yeah. So I think Victoria and New South Wales, for a long time, we had this idea that we could maintain zero COVID. You know, we had this sort of almost, initially in Victoria, we were very successful in suppressing the virus down to zero. And they used to call them donut days, you know, because zero is like a donut. And, you know, they'd all get excited and stuff. But I think we've reached the point now where they've accepted that that's actually just not achievable anymore. And now they're saying, okay, well, we need to aim for a vaccination rate, which they're talking, you know, it's still not clear. They're saying 70 to 80%. Now, in Victoria, the government said, oh, well, on the 23rd of September, assuming we reach a 70% vaccination rate, we will loosen some of the lockdown provisions. But when I say loosening, what I'm talking about is they're going to allow you to travel 10 kilometres from your house. They're going to allow you to outside for 3 hours a day instead of two. Maybe they'll consider opening schools, but that's still not sure. And so, you know, the freedoms that we're talking about here are pretty minimal. New South Wales, they're sort of saying, well, once we reach, I think they've said 70% will allow people who are vaccinated to, you know, visit each other and do certain things. But again, it calls into question, you know, this idea of being forced to have a medical procedure before you can participate in society. I question the idea of consent around this because, you know, I've got nothing against vaccines. I think, you know, if people want to take vaccines or any other medical procedure, that's their right. But consent to any sort of medical procedure needs to be free of coercion, right? And when you have a situation where your liberty or your livelihood is dependent on taking a medical procedure, I question whether the consent's valid. In fact, I would say it's not valid consent at all. And I'm not only concerned about the current situation, but I'm concerned about the precedent that we're setting here of having government force medical procedures on people without their valid consent, for the greater good. I think this is a very concerning development. And anyone who's familiar with the history of governments that, force medical procedures onto people without their consent or do it currently would be horrified by this precedent.
I certainly am, and we're facing something very much like that right now in the United States, so we have our hands full with that. It's no Australia situation, but there are a lot of people who have had very long careers, and they are just absolutely refusing to do this, and so their lives are ruined. The lunatic who runs this country has ruined the lives of countless people with this particular intervention. Now, what, on the other hand, playing devil's advocate, what do you say to your fellow elected officials who say, you can't argue with success. We've done really well with COVID, with this strategy. I mean, why would you want to do what these other countries are doing where they wind up with atrocious numbers of deaths, let's say? That's what they would say. How do you respond?
I think that that's looking at it in too narrow a view. In fact, I think that's been the problem all along, is that they're just focusing on cases and deaths and sort of almost ignoring the harms that they're causing by the emergency. Like, we're under a state of emergency at the moment, and we have been since March last year now, under these emergency provisions, because, the harms to people's health, the harms to children, the harms to the economy, the harms to all of these things, I don't think that they're being properly weighed up. And I think in the future, we're going to look back at this and say, did we really make the right decisions here? And in many ways, the things that we were aiming for, like COVID zero, turned out to be unattainable anyway. And we really just kicked the can down the road a bit, and at great, great expense in both financial and, social costs, and created this massive division within our society. I'll give you an example of how extreme it is. Yesterday, there was children have started civil disobedience, basically, because they've had enough. And teenagers were going down to a bike track, like a BMX bike track, and they weren't meant to be going down there. And the local government brought in, these concrete barriers to to stop kids going down there. And like all the kids were like holding their bikes above their head and yelling at them and stuff. And then, yesterday I went down to the local basketball court with one of my kids. I've got three boys myself, young boys, and, they're going stir crazy. So I thought I'll take them down to the basketball court and shoot some hoops. They've unscrewed the hoops from the basketball courts. So you can't actually play basketball. Like, this is some really extreme stuff. They closed down the playgrounds at one stage for little kids. That was what sent me over the edge. Like, I was absolutely wild about that. My colleague and I ended up sitting out the front of Parliament holding a sign saying, open the parks and let kids play. And, we sat there basically protesting. But, we said that we were exercising parliamentary business because they'd shut down Parliament. We said it's part of our job. The police, I think, wanted to arrest us, but I'm not sure that they had a legal basis to do so. So they left us alone for a while. But, we were pretty upset about when they closed down the parks. Now, I think the government realised that they'd gone too far then. So they said, all right, well, we'll open up the parks again. They were upset that parents were, meeting each other and talking to each other, But for many parents, this was like one of the last things that they had left to sort of, keep their sanity and give their kids something to do. But when they opened the parks up again, they said, all right, only one parent is allowed to go there, down there at a time. Children over 12 aren't allowed to go there. And parents aren't allowed to remove their masks to drink a coffee or anything. And you've got to check in with the QR codes so that they can contact trace you if there's any disease transmission at the park. And it's this situation now where if you've got children under 12 and over 12, like I was told a story of, a family, they went down to the park. One of the kids was under 12 and one of them was a 14-year-old. And the 14-year-old was sort of you know, waiting, hovering in the distance, sort of worried about breaking the law and stuff because they might go down a slide. I mean, it's just outrageous what they're doing here.
Hey, friends, let's take just a minute to thank our sponsor, the official razor of the Tom Woods Show, and that is Harry's. As I've mentioned before, I used to use an electric shaver because I was afraid of a blade, because in the old days I would use a blade and I would just look terrible. I'd be all hacked up and whatever. Maybe I didn't know what I was doing, or maybe they were just lousy razors. And I'm inclined to that theory because every time I wind up getting some awful third-rate competitor to Harry's at the airport because I forgot my razor or something, it is like I'm in a CIA torture chamber. So if you don't know Harry's, it's time you do. Harry's was created to be different from other shaving companies. They're crafting high-quality, long-lasting blades, durable weighted handles, and they make a close, comfortable shave quick and, dare we say, enjoyable. Refill blades start as low as $2. And new Harry's customers get their starter set, which includes a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel with aloe, and a travel cover. It's a $13 value, all for just $3. Well, there's never been a better time to try Harry's. Go to harrys.com/woods to get their starter set for just $3. It's 100% satisfaction guaranteed, so you've got nothing to lose. Go to harrys.com/woods right now to get this special offer. That's harrys.com/woods. Well, I'm going to be very blunt, David. This is a prison. I mean, this is a country-sized prison. Yeah. And it doesn't seem like there's much prospect of things improving. It's totally irrationality and monomania, fixation on one particular thing to the exclusion of all else, not based in science in any way. The idea of closing playgrounds is, I mean, even our people, even our craziest people here don't advocate that. No. Why don't you pack up and leave? That's my question. Why would you, at this point, why wouldn't you say, this is hopeless, these people deserve what they get if they can't, there are more of them than they are of the enforcers. And at any time, they could say, enough is enough, and they refuse to do it even after all these indignities and the destruction of their lives, then you can have it. If this is what you want, you can have it, and I'm going to move somewhere else. Why don't you do that?
You can't do that in Australia at the moment. Australia is now one of the few countries in the world where you need to apply for an exit permit to actually leave, and they have very few conditions under which you're allowed to leave the country. Like I said, you can't even go 5 kilometres from your house. You can't cross state borders without special exemptions. Getting on a plane and moving to another country is, you know, basically, it's not impossible, but it's pretty hard. You know, Australia, like especially in Victoria, in my area, it's very high immigrant population. So lots and lots of people who have dual citizenship with other countries. And what I'm concerned about is when they do open the borders, there's going to be an exodus. Lots of people are just going to say, all right, I'm gone now. I've had enough of this. But yeah, if you wanted to leave and pack up and go at the moment, I just don't think it's practical. I don't think you can actually do it.
It's incredible. I mean, when you were talking about people being stuck and not being able to cross borders within the country, that did actually bring to mind, of course, what happened with East and West Berlin. And this sounds like it has to be an exaggeration when you say things like that. It sounds like it has to be hyperbole. But now you can't even get out of the country itself. So even if it's unbelievable, you can't even leave. So is there anything that gives you hope at this point?
Well, there is. I've said for a long time that the people that appreciate liberty the most are those who have had it taken away from them. And I feel like we're in a situation now where pretty much everyone in Australia has had their freedom taken away from them to some degree, especially children. And my hope here is that, you know, we're going to fight to get out of this. And, you know, I hope that we will get out of it. But my hope is that in the future, that both adults and the children who've had their freedoms taken away from them will guard them far more preciously than we have in the past, and will take measures to make sure that this never happens again.
Yeah, I guess that's got to be it. But it's very, very hard, I think, to make that kind of guarantee that it'll never happen again. Once it's happened and people have gone along with this, it's almost like there's very little they wouldn't go along with. And by the way, I think this is a question only of degree. I wouldn't say that I live in some uniquely fortunate place. I mean, I'm glad by comparison to other countries that I live where I live, but I'm also surrounded by crazy people who can't read charts and who are monomaniacally obsessed with one thing to the exclusion of everything else. and who have such a primitive understanding of economics that they think that we can all just stop production and that the government can print up money and that'll keep us going indefinitely. And they can't understand why there could be any problem with that. Very, very hard to continue to have a society on that basis when there's that little understanding of the most basic things. But that's the situation we face. Situation you face, it just seems so, so grim. Last question. What is, though, your assessment of the size of the population there that for whatever reason will decline the vaccine? I don't say refuse because that's a propaganda word. They'll decline the vaccine. How many, what percentage do you think there are? And they don't have to be ideologically anti-vaccine or something like that. They could be numerous reasons. They have an allergy to it or they feel like they've already had COVID, so it's pointless to take the vaccine. Do you think you guys will be able to get to 80% vaccinated?
I'm not sure. Like, you know, they keep talking about, you know, 70 to 80% vaccination rate. And that sort of implies that there's going to be 20 to 30% of people that won't take it for whatever reason. And, you know, I've said all along that it's people's choice to make these decisions. And, you know, whether someone's, you know, the risk assessment for a young person and for an older person is going to be very different, right? And so, you know, if they're saying that it's going to be 20 to 30% of the population that are going to have their rights taken away from them for some, you know, for some period of time, maybe forever, or they're going to lose their livelihoods, certainly that's going to shake up politics like you've never seen before, I would imagine.
Well, we can see. I mean, I would be making a deliberate attempt to reach out to what are normally politically apathetic young people. Young people in the U.S., at least, oh, they'll go out and hold a sign and they'll cheer for a charismatic politician they see on TV. But when push comes to shove, they don't show up to vote. They just do not show up to vote. And candidates who rely on their votes wind up not doing so well. It's the older folks who wind up voting. But I wonder if this time there might be some merit in speaking directly to them and saying, don't ever forget who did this to you, that what's being done now cannot possibly be justified on any level and is deeply and profoundly inhumane and is being imposed on you by people who are operating in defiance of just the most basic norms of what it means to be a human being. And it's extremely selfish of anyone to expect this of you as children, because these selfish people themselves, when they were children, they got to have normal lives. And when they were teenagers, they got to have normal lives and have all the irreplaceable pleasures of teenage and life and childhood. And they've taken that away from you selfishly to protect, supposedly to protect them. But that's not the way it's supposed to be. Older people are supposed to protect you, younger people, and they have abysmally failed at that. Don't ever forget it. That's the kind of thing I would do as a Hail Mary out of desperation. I would make a direct appeal to them and say, the young people have got to lead us out of this because you're the ones who are being victimized the most.
I think that's already happening. I mean, you know, if you look at the protests, a lot of these people protesting are young people. A lot of the people that, you know, becoming interested in and joining our party are young people. And we have an unusual voting system in Australia. We also have compulsory voting. So the idea of not turning up to vote is something that doesn't happen. You have to turn up to vote or you get a fine. Although my party's opposed to that, in this case, I think it'll actually work to everyone's advantage because these young people, they're mad. Like, especially when you consider the types of work that a lot of these young people are in, you know, like they were working in restaurants, they were working in a lot of these, you know, they were going to universities and these sort of things that have been shut down, and they're mad, they're upset, and, you know, they're having some of the best years of their life taken away from them, and they're the ones that are protesting, they're the ones that are on the streets and mad. And it's not just young people, like a lot of religious people as well have been very upset that they haven't been able to conduct ceremonies and things like this. So there's been people from the faith community that are very upset too. But yeah, there's a lot of young people that, you know, we've been talking to, and they're very upset, and they want to make sure that, you know, to try and do something to make sure that this doesn't happen again. I think the number one thing in Victoria that we could do, and this is what my party's actually tried to do through what's called a private members bill, is place better accountabilities and restrictions on these emergency powers that we have here. You know, initially we've had these emergency powers on the books for years, but we've never really used them much. And they were initially only meant to go for 6 months, and they kept voting through these extensions, which we, of course, opposed. But we need to have better accountability on how these powers are used.
Well, that is an understatement. I mean, we all have our own problems in every country of the world, but what can Americans of goodwill do? Is there anything we can do to help?
Look, I think, you know, this is one of the reasons I'm talking to you, and I've talked to other. I know that America's showing a lot of interest in Australia at the moment, and we really appreciate that. I think Australians need to wake up to the fact that what we're doing here is really extreme, and that large parts of the other world are getting on with their lives, you know, with less or more restrictions, you know, differing levels of restrictions. But if America, you know, pays more attention to what's happening in Australia and supports those voices that are speaking out against these draconian measures, then, you know, that would be helpful to Australia, I think. We need to get rid of this island mentality that, you know, we're somehow different from the rest of the world, and that we're special, and that, you know, what we're doing is morally superior, and all that, like you spoke about before.
Do you have a, does your party have a website I can link people to, for one thing?
Yeah, so our party website is ldp.org.au, and I'm also on Twitter and Facebook. If you just do a search for David Limbrick MP on Twitter or Facebook, you'll find me there, and I talk a lot about these sort of things. And if Americans are interested in following what's going on here, I talk about it quite often and have things to say about it. So, yeah, I appreciate people following and paying attention.
Yes, I'm, as a matter of fact, as of right now, I'm following you on Twitter. So I'll put the link to all these things that you just mentioned on our show notes page. That's tomwoods.com/1972, because we should be hearing from a sensible voice coming out of Australia. And you're the most sensible one I've found so far. So we're gonna have people follow you, and just, my gosh, I hope things improve is all I can say. I hope things improve.
I feel like the pendulum is starting to swing the other way now, is what I'd say. I think closing the playgrounds is about as bad as it got, and I'm hoping that we're moving back the other way. But we've still got this big fight on, you know, this idea of vaccine passports and things like that. So I don't know how that's going to play out.
Yeah. I don't know either. It's so interesting, though, to watch contrary examples. I'll let you go after this, but Moscow had something like that for restaurants. Yep. And about a month later, after the restaurant owners had been screaming about what this had done to business, they just scrapped the whole thing. And then likewise, it made big news the other day when Denmark scrapped everything, all the COVID restrictions. They scrapped them all, including their internal pass system, where they had something like that for a number of months, and then they simply got rid of it. So for anybody who is feeling absolute despair, and I completely understand that. I succumb to that sometimes too. We have these examples. It does not have to go on like this. There's no reason that Denmark, that the people of Denmark are somehow, they're from another species and they're completely unique and nothing that happens in Denmark is reproducible elsewhere. No, nonsense. It can be reproduced elsewhere. And here's hoping it's reproduced enough to yield a free Australia sometime in the near future.
This is what we've been promoting. Rather than the idea of setting some sort of vaccination target, we should set a date on when all this is going to end. And we've been promoting the idea of Freedom Day. So I know other countries have done this on December 4th, that all the restrictions, like everything, should just be switched off on a certain date. And I think that gives people hope, and it allows people to plan for the future. It gives people time who want to get a vaccine, who haven't had access to one, to get access to one. And for those who choose not to have it, to choose not to have it. And, you know, eventually we have to face up to the reality that COVID is coming to Australia and people are going to have to, you know, either make a choice of take their chances with COVID or take their chances with the vaccine. You know, it's their choice. And that's what I think we should be doing in Australia. And I think, you know, setting a date makes that very clear to people that, you know, we're not going to do this forever.
No, because what would be the point of living, right? At some point, you have to ask that simple question. What would be the point of living if all you're doing is sheltering yourself from something that probably is not going to do that much to you? I mean, it can knock you out for a little while, it's true, but probably you're going to be okay. Chances are you're going to be okay. And there are even older people who know that they are more vulnerable than others. There are some of them who say, well, look, I'm going to take my chances because I love my grandkids and I can't let them grow up like this. How selfish of me would that be? I can't let this happen. And I know there are people like that. I recommended there should be an organization called Grandmas Against Lockdowns. No one has taken me up on that. I thought it was
I like that. I think my mom would probably join that organization.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So would mine. Absolutely. All right. Well, tomwoods.com/1972 will have links so you can follow David, find out more about his party and the stuff that they're up to. Well, keep on fighting. That's all you can do in this situation. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks. I remember I had Mark Sisson on the show not too long ago when we were talking about health and nutrition and diet and just how to live a healthy lifestyle. Well, a lot of you folks were very happy about that because a lot of you are indeed pursuing precisely that kind of food regimen. Well, it turns out that a Tom Woods Show listener just created lowcarbabode.com. It's a keto recipe and health site. And it's got delicious keto recipes for you and that your kids will like. Comfort foods, special desserts, international low-carb recipes, you name it. The writer and recipe developer behind it is a homeschooling mom of three who turned to a low-carb way of eating after she was diagnosed with gestational diabetes during her second pregnancy. Well, many of her keto recipes are inspired by her German-Russian heritage, like meringue cheesecake, rustic bread, or berry marshmallows. All her recipes are grain-free, low-carb, and gluten-free. So check them out, lowcarbabode.com, linked to tomwoods.com/1972. And of course, remember, you want to start a website? Check out Woods' special benefits. Just get your hosting through my link, and I will help get you some nice advantages out of the gate with my free bonuses. Get the details on all that at tomwoods.com/publicity. Tomorrow we'll be talking to Rafi Farber out of Israel to find out what is going on there. I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.